I'm grateful to the organizers for being asked to give this kind of talk. I've had a lot of joy reading Jack's papers again, I mean, or looking at them at least, and some of them for the first time. So I've called the talk A Holomorphic Tale, and with the subtitle Glimpses of Holomorphic Dynamics in the Light of Jack's Influence and of Its Development. And it can only be brief sketches. So there is a wonderful book by Jack, which just came out in the third edition, in some revised version. I haven't had time really to look at it, but new stuff has been added, and it came out this year in Princeton University Press. Then there are Jack's expository papers. And typically, they first came out as preprints if they didn't exist earlier in rough drafts. And then years later, they were published, often quite a number of years later. So Jack gave us the opportunity to look into his writing. The field would develop from looking into his writing. And then he would have, I guess, a terrible job of making appropriate acknowledgement to what has happened in between. His writing is renowned for clarity, elegance, completeness, and beautiful computer pictures. Having just praised Jack for giving appropriate acknowledgement to all the others' work, I'm going to violate that principle completely. I know that I ought to give, quote, quite a number of you in the audience, and this is hereby done. So I have chosen three themes from Jack's works, and I hope that will illustrate his different kind of influence on the field. The first thing will be about modular spaces, in particular from cubic polynomials, brief mentioning of quadratic rational maps. The next thing will be combinatorial methods called orbit portraits, and the last thing, Matins and Lattice examples. So let's look at the pictures which appear in a paper that was published in 92 as the very first paper in Experimental Mathematics first volume. I have some pages with these pictures dated 86, and what they show are a real slice, a real slice for cubic polynomials. You can parametrize all complex cubic polynomials in this way, with the critical points being plus minus a, and such cubic polynomials are holomorphic conjugate if and only if the parameters have this relation with all possible plus minus variations. So you can see, as Jad did, you can choose the square of a and you can choose the square of b to be your coordinates, and then we will have exactly one representative for each holomorphic conjugacy class. And these pictures are in the capital A, capital B plane, and in particular, we are seeing something in the quadrant with A positive and B negative. In this case, if we take the real representation, meaning having real coefficients, we need the leading coefficient minus one, and the two critical points will be complex conjugate, and therefore their orbit will be complex conjugated. So what we see here is a distorted copy of the Mandelbrot set, and it suggested non-locally connectedness of the connectedness locus of the cubic polynomials, and it was proved not only for the real slice but for the connectedness locus in general in the cubic case, and in fact we have non-locally connectedness for all connectedness loci in degree 3 and higher up. So the only open question is the Mandelbrot set. So if we have a center of a hyperbolic component, there are two different kinds of behavior. Both critical points can be periodic with disjoint orbits, or one is falling on the other, which is then symmetrically going back to the first. And we see an enlargement from the first picture here, where we have this second kind of behavior. And Jack gave the prototype model for this, the tricorn, which is the connectedness locus for biquadratic maps in the form Z squared plus C, the whole thing squared, and then going back with a quadratic polynomial with the parameter C bar. So that's the real family of these maps. So just to say a few words about quadratic rational maps, there is a strong analogy between the theory of quadratic rational maps and cubic polynomials. So you will see the papers mentioned. Here is the one on the cubic maps. Here is the one on the rational maps, also from experimental mathematics. There is a good reason for this analogy. Both families have two free critical points. Another way of saying that they are similar are that they have three fixed points, where you count for the rational map the fixed point in the sphere and for the polynomial in the plane. And the moduli space is in both cases C2. I'll come back to quadratic rational maps later on. But now I'm moving to the next theme. Sorry it's so brief, but that's how it goes. So that's the one about orbit portraits. So what is an orbit portrait? So the writing about orbit portraits appear in the paper on periodic orbit external rays and the Mandelbrot set, which is published in the proceedings of Adrien Duhadie's 60th birthday conference. And it builds on the earlier paper by Jag and Lisa Goldberg on fixed-point portraits. The main purpose of that paper is to give an alternative and simplified proof of the landing of pyramidal rays for quadratic polynomials. And that proof is combinatorial in nature, building on orbit portraits. For me, it was very exciting to read this. It's like reading a detective story, and exciting, although I knew the plot. I knew which parameter rays would eventually catch which parameter points. But still, it was fantastic to see the whole thing unraveled in a new way, in a simplified way, with a different order and with a different logic behind. So what is an orbit portrait? Jack is giving several examples, and let's take his example. Here you see a period 2 orbit, and the rays that land on these two periodic points, there are 3 for each point, so there are 6 rays altogether, and the rays form a periodic orbit of period 6. So the denominator is 1 over 63. So the unit here is 1 over 63. So A1 will give us the angles attached to the first periodic point here, and A2 the angles to the second. And I've just ordered them that 22 goes to 44, goes to 25, that's much 63, goes to 50, goes to 37, goes to 11, and back to 22. Another example is that we have a period 5 orbit. A point here goes to here, goes here, goes here, goes here, and then goes back. And for each of these periodic points, there are 2 rays landing. So we have now two rays of period 5 with denominator 31. 11 goes to 22, goes to 13, goes to 26, goes to 21 and back, and similarly for the other, the partner. So motivated by that, we can say, what is an orbit portrait? It's a collection of arguments, angles, as many as we have periodic points in the orbit. And then such an orbit portrait has the following properties. Each of these angle sets is a finite subset of the rational numbers. We have a bijection under doubling from one set to the next. And it preserves the cyclic order. There is a number r greater than or equal to 1 such that any angle has the same period rp under doubling, and all of these sets are pairwise unlinked. So given these properties, we can make a definition saying whenever we have a set of angles satisfying these four properties, we'll call that an orbit portrait. So you could feel like I'm cheating, or Jack is cheating. I mean, we're looking at some well-known examples and so on. But you can just play with these numbers and say, if you want more than one ray to land at each point, this is the only other possibility you can have satisfying the four rules. So, I mean, take this as a motivation, take then the things out abstractly, and you can play with it. So, the number of rays in each set is called the valence, V, and necessarily this number R that we have to multiply P with to get the ray period will have to be less than or equal to V, because there is a total number of V times P rays. And then there is a lemma saying that any orbit portrait is, in fact, realized by a quadratic polynomial. So I do have the ambition to give you the argument for the landing. Let's see if I will succeed. So I just said that R has to be less than or equal to V. So in fact, there are only two cases like we have seen here, because if R is strictly less than V, one can prove that R must be 1 and V will be 2, and that the orbit portrait is just made out of one orbit, as in the first case. And if R is equal to V, then there must be two orbits, as in the second case. Sorry? Yes. Okay. Yeah. So this one goes to the second here, and the second here goes to the first. Yeah, thank you. And then one can show that for each orbit portrait, there is a unique smallest arc. In this case, it's the arc here between 22 over 63 and 25 over 63. There's a unique arc among all the complementary arcs for the orbit portrait. And here it's some other interval. And this is characterizing the portrait completely. If you know this interval, you can reconstruct the portrait. So, sorry? V, valence, the number of points in each angle set. So let's see if I can succeed. So the main theorem is bigger than I've stated, but the short version is that there are two parameter rays, exactly those that we had given for the portrait, bounding this characteristic arc. They land at a common parabolic point. So to prepare for this, we have to look at C values outside the Mandelbrot set. And a lot of the rays for such a C value, I'm now talking about dynamic rays, will land, but they may also bounce. And if they bounce, they do so at a pre-critical point. And we can give a characterization of which rays will bound. It bounces if and only if C is on a parameter ray with a particular T value, if that T value is in the set of doubling of theta. Then the key lemma for getting the main theorem is that for a C outside M, the FC admits a periodic orbit with portrait P if and only if C is on the parameter ray of angle T of C, and this T of C has to be in the characteristic arc. And this is proved purely combinatorially. Now comes the sketch of the proof. So we take an orbit portrait. We take any T, any angle in the orbit portrait, and we take an accumulation point of the parameter ray for such a T value. Looking at the neighborhood of such accumulation point, there will be C values, namely C values on the parameter ray for the T, such that we have rays bouncing. Therefore, the accumulation point C naught must have the following property, that there is orbit point for in the Julia set such that this is fixed under iteration by r to the p, and that the derivative for such a point is plus 1. If it was not so, then such a t value would land at a repelling periodic point, and the portrait would be stable. And we're just seeing that that's not so, because there are C values arbitrarily close to the accumulation point where it's bouncing off. So, therefore, the ray must in fact land at C naught, because there are only finitely many C values with this property. So you can see the only thing I'm using here in holomorphic thing is that a repelling point together with the rays landing in it will move holomorphically in the neighborhood of that C value. Okay, so this ray lands at C naught. Then the second step is that we look at all the T values still in the portrait. We take away the parameter rays for these T values and their landing point. This is an open set in parameter plane. Suppose the two rays would land at different points, as I have suggested. Here, this ray may then be connected to another one of the rays, but in any ways, it would violate the key lemma, because we would have, say, T values on both sides of the ray with the same portrait. And we can only have the portrait realized if we have a T value within the arc, also in parameter plane. Okay, this was a sketch of the proof. So what I want to get across is that it's mainly using purely combinatorial descriptions. There are a few steps using holomorphic things, but very basic. So it's a simplified proof. Now, the third theme starts with matings, and Jack's paper on that is pasting together, Julia sets a worked out example of matings. So in that paper, he gives a very concrete example. He gives a survey of matings, and he tells us how we can understand this very concrete example in different ways. So here is the beginning of how can we view mating. Let me see if I can put this more or less on top. So we can think of given two quadratic polynomials with connected Julia set and locally connected as well, so that we have the Cartier-Hodori loop parametrization of the Julia set. Then we place one of the filled Julia sets on the upper hemisphere and another one on the lower one. So you simply think of that you have the sphere and you have the tangent plane with this C plane with everything on the north pole, and then you make a projection from the center of the sphere to get it onto the sphere. It's not a holomorphic map, it's just a topological way to see it. And in this way, the equator circle will be the circle at infinity for the upper complex plane. Then we take another copy, we turn the paper around, put it on the south pole, and we project in a similar way from the center everything until the lower hemisphere. Then we get a topological mating by identifying the ray of argument T upstairs with the ray of argument minus T downstairs, and the dynamics will fit under doubling on the equator. We take the smallest equivalence relation we can, so that the closure of T ray and the closure of the minus T ray downstairs is in one equivalent class. So if a point here has another ray landing at that point, we continue and go down, and we may have to go up and down a number of times. Then it's not clear at all that we get in the quotient space a sphere, but there is a topological theorem of Moore saying that we get the quotient space to be homeomorphic to the sphere if there is no equivalent class separating the sphere into two or more connected components. So suppose we have this situation, then the two quadratic maps induces a map on the sphere, from the sphere to the sphere of degree 2. And then there is another name. We say that we have a geometric mating of the two quadratic polynomials if this construction is topologically conjugate to a rational map of degree 2. So suppose, again, that this is how it is. Then Jack worked out, okay, no, I have a picture here downstairs. That's just to mention that the cover of the Stony Brook preprint series is a mating of the basilica situation with the rabbit situation, you see here, where one critical point is placed at infinity, mapping to here and back, and the other one at zero and mapping here and back. So what is the worked out example that Jack is giving us? He's taking a dendrite. He's taking the special C value, which is the landing point of the 1/4 ray in parameter space. So we have 0 being mapped to this landing point of 1/4, then map to the landing point of 1/2, then map to the landing point of 0 ray, and therefore, so we have 0, critical value, prefixed point, and fixed point. So the critical point is pre-periodic. We know that Julia said is a dendrite. And then we can look at the self-mating of this map. And in fact, it will give us a geometric mating, but it's not clear how to understand that we really get that mating this by itself, it will fill the whole sphere. So that's the purpose of looking at this worked out example, among other things. So here's a drawing. We have a rough copy on the upper hemisphere and another copy on the lower hemisphere, and that we see that we have to identify the two beta fixed points, because the 0 ray should be extended with a 0 ray. We also have to identify the two prefixed points, because the 1/2 ray should be identified with the 1/2 ray. I mean, plus minus 1/2. And therefore, we will get in the critical orbit behavior that we have two critical points being mapped to two critical values, which are then prefixed and then fixed. And for the, after having gone to a rational map, we see that this is exactly one of the lattice maps of degree 2, and it can be written in the forms choosing the critical points to be plus minus 1, and if this is the form, then the critical values will be plus minus I, and then it maps to 0, then to infinity, with a particular choice of points. So this is the easiest lattice examples to understand, I would say. So forget about the I's that occur here, because here it means something else. This is just a parametrization. Here we're going to play with the model in a simplified version, in the sense that we take the lattice, which is generated by 1 and I. So you see part of that. The quotient space will give us a torus. Then we take the linear map, which is multiplying any point by 1 minus I. Just look at that in the whole complex plane. This will take the lattice into itself, and therefore it induces a map on this level. And you see here in blue the image of the unit square. So you see that it has a double area, and therefore the map here has degree 2. Then we make an extra identification to come from the torus to the sphere, namely identifying set with minus set. So this is a torus over the identification plus minus. After having done that, we can shrink even more to a fundamental domain. That's what you see here. So it's chosen with 0, then it goes only halfway here and halfway to the other side, but it's still a unit length, but it has height of 1/2. And this is a pillowcase, because this part has to be identified with this under the symmetry plus minus. This one has to be identified with this already from the torus construction, and this one is by minus going up here, which then has to be identified with this one. So that's a pillowcase where you just fold. It's not really quadratic. So this corner has to be identified with this, this with that, And in this construction up here, everything is nice, holomorphic, and we see a holomorphic copy of the sphere. Here we see it more with an orbifold structure. But still, we're going to play with this. And the reason for that is that here we can work with the linear map. So we can understand the whole construction by working with the linear map. So the next thing Jack introduces, that is one of the classical fractal constructions, the highway dragon construction. Highway is the name of a person. I would hear it differently otherwise. So we start with a line segment, and you should think of this. Now I got lost. Oh, here I am. You should think of this as zero and this point. So I'm just looking at a line segment. The next step in the fractal construction is that we make a right triangle, and we go to the left. Next step, we have this. You see it here? So again, we make a right triangle going to the left. But then we continue with the right triangle going to the right. And the reason for that is that we play a game saying this is an old vertex, this is a new vertex, and whenever we see a new vertex compared to the last step, we go right. So we continue doing this and that, and you see it gets more and more fractal. And it goes very much beyond the square we could put in. Okay, why does that help us in any way to understand what's going on? Jack is giving us this picture, saying that under this construction, do this a lot of times. It's not that many times, I've forgotten if it's nine. Put it all in a fundamental domain. This is a different choice of a fundamental domain. Then he made a bit of a perturbation so that you don't just see coincidences like this, but you kind of see which way you are traveling. Okay, so how can we understand this? We look at the Hopper tree for this particular polynomial. We can also just look at its spine, so the arc from minus beta to beta, it's a very fractal arc. And then we can start to pull back that spine, so we get a symmetric picture first, then we get more and more branches, and at the end, that means at the infinite end, we'll have a set which is dense in the Julia set. Okay, here is how I understand the relationship with this picture. So before I was just talking about this kind of line segment, now I take another line segment and I kind of think of them as naive ways of drawing spines of the two different Julia sets. Then the linear map here we'll take this zigzag, double covering this. I mean, I'll put it back into the fundamental domain. And if you see that this red is in fact the same as this, this red is the same as that, this blue is the same as that. I'm just, if we take the pillowcase, I'm just making the square. Then I take pre-image under L an extra time and I get this. And then I put it back into the fundamental domain. So I can travel like red, blue. This is the same corner as here. Blue, red, blue, red. And I'm back to where I started. And I've created like a square-like pattern, but with a smaller size. And in this way, at least that's my understanding of the way we can get such a picture. So we see how we get a piano curve-like construction of the Julia said, filling out the sphere. And when we do not make the perturbation but close it up more, we will see more and more pinching points coming together, which is what one pinching on one copy is not the same place as for the other one, so they interact. That's how I understand it. Okay, so I just have one more thing to say. So by this, I wanted to illustrate Jack's putting many different things together, giving a clear picture, and still in the same, at the same time giving a survey, it was, of matings. But it wasn't so much a survey of lattice maps, but he has another paper giving such a survey on lattice maps, and it just came out this year too, and I think I'm allowed to advertise for this beautiful book because my only contribution is that I turned 60, and Jack's paper is the first one in that volume. So it's a very complete account, I say, of lattice maps. First, the finite number of those in degree 2, and then in higher degrees, and where it's possible also to have flexible lattice example, where you have whole neighborhoods of examples that stay stable. So this is the end of my talk. I want to say again, it's such a pleasure to read Jack. I can recommend it to every one of you. It's fascinating, and I can guarantee that anyone will learn something new, even if you read it many, many times, each time.